On March 29th, six women held a sit-in in Indian Affairs Minister Chuck Strahl's office, demanding that funding be restored to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. The foundation, which funded over 130 programs for Aboriginal survivors of violence and abuse in the residential school system, did not have its funding renewed in the latest federal budget. This announcement comes just about a year after the Canadian government's official apology to victims of residential schools. All six women who were involved in the sit-in were arrested within an hour without a response from Strahl. I'm on the line now with Maya Rolbengani, a member of Missing Justice and one of the participants in the sit-in, to talk about this action and the impacts of these cuts. So I just wanted to start off by talking a bit about the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. Mm-hmm. So what is the impact that those cuts will have on survivors of residential schools?
Well, the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, which was established in 1998, funded 134 Native-run, community-based healing initiatives across the country called Canada. And, I mean, all sorts of different projects, community-based, frontline, on-the-ground projects, from, some of them were funding women's shelters, Native women's shelters. Others were funding different sorts of counseling for survivors of residential schools, from anger management to services provided to sexual offenders themselves. To just you name it, there was all, like, every sort of program out there was existing. I mean, basically, most of the directors of projects that I've spoken to had no clue that the funding was going to be cut, so they weren't prepared for it in any way. The reasons for which most people were not prepared are many and complicated. The Aboriginal Healing Foundation was evaluated on numerous occasions. The most notable of which was actually a government-commissioned study that was done only a few months ago in December, and actually a second study was done and released the day after the cuts took effect on March 31st, 2010, and both of them praised the Aboriginal Healing Foundation to such a degree and talked about how, concluded that no other organization could do this sort of work with the same rate of success as the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, and not only praised the fact that they were doing such amazing work and that they were, their enrollment was up 40%, people in communities were really benefiting from a lot of these services, from sexual assault counseling to whatever else. A lot of the services were really sort of actually saving lives. Suicide prevention was also included among them. And hard to reach sectors of the Native community were being successfully targeted as well, such as men and youth. And so they concluded all of these things in this government study not long before the cuts took effect. And they also concluded that most of the projects, the 134 projects, would probably not survive without the Aboriginal Healing Foundation funding. And they went further to even praise the fiscal organizational aspects of the organization, and the audits were exemplary and so on. So it wasn't like there was any funny business going on with the finances or anything like that. And then they actually made a recommendation to the federal government to continue to renew the funding at the very, very, very least until the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement was up, which is in 2011. And the settlement agreement is basically an agreement that gives small monetary compensation to survivors of residential schools, which I'm not knocking, which I think is great on its own level. People get a few thousand dollars if they're a proven, survivor of residential schools. But the actual on-the-ground programs that were doing a world of good in a lot of people's lives were basically interrupted midstream on March 31st when the cuts took effect. And the impact that this has on a lot of individual people's lives, as well as the lives of communities, Native communities in general, because a lot of them were community-based, is just really, really, really damaging and really traumatic for a lot of people. Not only that, but a lot of people that were accessing these services were just beginning to make progress, and a lot of people were just beginning to be able to talk about what they'd experienced in residential schools. And this is just like, you know, taking the rug out from under them. Another reason that that this was as damaging as it was and is as damaging as it is, because people are in the middle of closing the doors in a lot of cases to a lot of these organizations that were doing this work. They're like, a lot of them are closing down right now if they haven't already, because they've lost the majority, if not all, of their funding. The budget, the throne speech that was given before the budget, and even the budget itself, which was presented on March 4th, 2010, was extremely misleading in the sort of language that it used, such that a lot of people that I've spoken to at the AHF itself just really just did not expect this. They were shocked. So the sort of language that was used was such that, you know, the Canadian government's going to pledge $199 million to addressing the legacy of residential schools, and a large part of this is going to go to, mental and emotional health services or something along those lines. People at the Aboriginal Healing Foundation heard that, saw that, and thought, well, that's us. We're covered. It's going to be fine. We're getting our funding. And that, along with the fact that they had received nothing but rave reviews from different government parties and from the study that I mentioned earlier. But then we find out not long after, this is after, you know, the media hears this, the media hears about the $199 million and covers it in such a way that, you know, they're like, okay, well, this funding's being renewed, there's no scandal here whatsoever. And then a week or so later, when people start to find out where the money's actually going, I think it was actually more than a week, it comes out that the money's actually going half to Health Canada, government program. Basically with the expectation that Health Canada is somehow going to, replace what the Aboriginal Healing Foundation was providing, which, you know, it's been acknowledged, even in the study I mentioned earlier, the government study, that Health Canada provides different sorts of services to Native communities. You know, they have a First Nations and Inuit health branch, but by no means are they going to provide the culturally specific services that the Aboriginal Healing Foundation did. So, like, you know, a program under the Aboriginal Healing Foundation might prescribe a sweat lodge ceremony for somebody that needs it, but there's no way that Health Canada is going to. On top of that, the Aboriginal Healing Foundation programs will definitely have more further reach into Native communities. Whereas Health Canada, they're just absent in a lot of the places that people require these services. And it's been acknowledged by politicians and grassroots activists alike that the sorts of services that are provided in these two places are complementary, but by no means do they do the same thing. So the money has been completely ripped from the Aboriginal Healing Foundation and is going to Health Canada instead. This is problematic on a number of levels, because a lot of people that survived residential schools don't trust government programs, and rightly so. And secondly, the sort of bureaucratic process that one needs to go through to access Health Canada services is completely different than the process one had to go through to access a lot of the services that AHF programs were providing. The list of problems is really long. And then, so half is going to Health Canada, and the other half of that $199 million is going to the settlement agreement that basically provides, you know, small monetary compensation to those that can prove they were in a residential school. And the on-the-ground frontline work that's being done, that was doing amazing stuff, exists no more. So that's like the basic background on why, you know, what was going on with the budget cuts and the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, and what prompted our action. It's one of those things where actually the majority of MPs in Parliament, with the exception of the Conservatives, of course, were actually well well-educated on the matter and actually united against the cuts. You know, I mean, the day after we did the sit-in, there was a six-hour emergency debate called in Parliament where everybody, NDP, Bloc Québécois, and Liberals alike, none of whom I ever take much interest in myself, I'm not a party politics person, but they were all, you know, just saying how much of a disaster this would be if the cuts took effect, and it just didn't make any difference whatsoever, because the very next day, the cuts took effect, and a lot of places closed down, and the place closest to me, the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal, lost a third of their funding, lost three employees, including a sexual assault counselor, even though the majority of the women that they serve, over 200 women, have been sexually assaulted. And now they're able to provide food and shelter, and that's it. I'm just really appalled at what the government, you know, says its priorities are, which are, you know, missing and murdered Native women and survivors of residential school, and what they've actually shown to be true with this last budget and with their every action. Anyway, I'll stop there for that.
Okay, well, you and the other members of the sit-in, can you hear me, Maya?
Yeah.
Okay. So you and the other members of the sit-in were all members of Missing Justice. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So, and your mandate is to take action on missing and murdered Indigenous women, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you see the cuts to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation as relating to that mandate?
Well, we've made lots of links in our organizing with Native communities in and around Montreal, so people in Ganawage, in Ottawa, in Kitigan-Zibi, Barrier Lake, and other places, and have been slowly forging links with communities in the city of Montreal as well. And the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal sort of sent an emergency call out when they found out that their funding was getting cut. And, the communities that access the Native women that are accessing the shelter services are, I mean, in every way, are from a lot of the same communities that of people that, of women that are targets of violence and of communities that we're trying to work with. And there's a huge overlap. I mean, the very issue of missing and murdered Native women is highly, highly affected by the fact that a lot of people in the communities which are seeing the highest rates of violence against Native women are also full of people that survived residential schools, and you can't escape the causal relationship between the two. And a lot of women that have gone missing or been murdered have been survivors of residential schools themselves, or the children of survivors of residential schools, one or the other. And the intergenerational impacts are just really, really, really strong. We saw it as linked in every single way. And if the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal loses their funding, then that highly impacts our work as well. We really wanted to support them, and we recognize that they were only one of 134 organizations that were losing their funding, and the total sum of damage in the end is just hard to grasp, considering that the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal on its own being cut seemed like an appalling level of damage. Mm-hmm. So we, in consultation with them and in consultation with other affected communities, including people involved in the AHF themselves, who couldn't take action on their own because it's written into their funding agreement that they're not allowed to do any sort of political advocacy, and in consultation with other directly affected people who, for one reason or another, couldn't take such an action themselves, but, you know, approved of it, we took this action, and we saw it as a complementary action to other actions that had already been taken by Native communities, such as petitions that had been being circulated, such as open letters, such as government lobbying, and so on. But none of these had succeeded in convincing the conservative government to renew the funding. So we took it to the next level, in the hopes of getting, you know, more media attention and raising the profile of the issue for average people that might not have known about it yet.
And so what was that successful? What was the reaction to your action? I know you were all arrested, and I understand that you had no response.
We did the sit-in out in the hallway outside of Chuck Strahl's office because for various reasons we couldn't get inside. I would say it was successful. Fairly successful. It definitely wasn't a failure. I don't think that it took anything away from the fight. I think it added to it. I think it was sort of appalling how quickly the whole action escalated. We were six women, and I think it had some effect on how the police, who happened to all be men, and white men at that, came in and treated us. In past things I've been involved in, the level of escalation has been much slower. We were basically, once security caught on and so on, and once they called the police, RCMP and OPP showed up pretty quickly. And then because of the RCMP, they basically told us, you know, you have 30 seconds to leave or we're going to arrest you. And that was sort of shocking to us because we thought we didn't expect it to happen that quickly. And, you know, we said we were going to sit there until Chuck Strahl pledged to renew funding to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. We stood our ground, but they really meant what they said about the 30 seconds, and they ended up physically removing all of us after that time was up, so 30 seconds. And, by that time, we'd already gotten word out to the media and so on. They took us down to the basement of the Confederation building instead of to jail, strangely, and processed us all in the same building and fined us all $65 and banned us from Parliament for a year, which a friend of one of the other members involved in the sit-in later compared to being banned from smelling farts for a year, which I keep having to repeat because I think it's really funny. In any case, we were then escorted to the sidewalk and told which side of the line was belonging to Parliament and which side of the line we were allowed to be on. And then there was a small support rally happening outside, so we joined them. APTN was out there. There were basically about 15 or so media articles generated about this across the country, which is, you know, not that much if you're thinking that it's all across the country, and not bad at the same time. And then a few radio and one TV interview, CBC Yellowknife. In that sense, the fact that there was any media attention at all was a success, in my opinion. Most of the articles were decent and had the issues straight. They mistook us for Native protesters because we didn't specify that we were, you know, non-Native. We assumed the media wouldn't assume things about us, but that was silly, and in the future we'll have to specify. But in the end, a lot of them corrected that mistake, and I don't think that really got in the way of the message and what was going on. And then the very next day, I'm not sure if our action contributed to it or not, but the very next day there was an emergency debate about the AHF funding called in Parliament, and that gave a chance to a lot of MPs to get really, really, really riled up about it, and I thought maybe it would make a difference. And I think it might still. The funding's been cut and so on, but a lot of people are still, you know, fighting and lobbying for the funding to be renewed. So who knows? I definitely think it added to raising the overall profile of the issue, and hopefully will contribute to an eventual renewing, contribute to the case for eventually renewing the funding. Another important thing about the fact that we are non-Native supporters supporting this cause which I brought up in later media interviews. Once a lot of the media had realized that we were in fact solidarity supporters and not from directly affected communities ourselves. I think it's really important, and I made a case for this in various interviews, to express exactly why it is that it's really, really important and significant for non-Native communities to show their support, and to express why it is that all people in Canada, all residents, should be concerned about these issues, not just Native people. I mean, when any sector of the population is, when their health and safety are under threat, then everybody should be concerned. And when survivors of residential schools from Native communities in this country are under threat, and their, you know, and life or death situations are being taken lightly, then everybody should be concerned, whether, no matter what color or culture you're from. So that was basically what I saw as the importance of expressing why it's important that we are non-Native. And if it had been Native people doing it, it would have been important for different reasons. Anyhow, that's...
Well, Maya, do you have any advice if people are listening to this and are concerned about this issue and want to take action? Do you have any advice about the kinds of actions that can be taken?
Yeah. There was information sent out in our press release, and I think it's still on our site on missingjustice.ca. There's basically, we have Chuck Strahl's phone number and fax number, and same as Stephen Harper's, but I would suggest that people phone up Chuck Strahl's office as often as possible to express concerns about this and to insist that he pledge to renew the funding. The more people that do that, the more annoying it is for them, and if people do it, if enough people do it on a sustained basis, then it actually does sometimes affect the decisions that these people make. Besides that, I don't think that on its own is necessarily enough. Besides that, I would say that getting a hold of the AHS, of people that work at the AHS themselves, as well as programs and projects in their own communities that have been affected by the AHS cuts, to find out what sorts of future actions and pressure tactics they want to see happen. Because, I mean, I'm pretty sure that most people in Canada live fairly close to at least one project that has either had to close their doors in the last couple of weeks or has suffered immensely. And I would suggest that getting in touch with those projects on a local level and figuring out what they want to see happen next is a really smart next step. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thanks.
That would be the most important thing, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks so much, Maya. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Let's see. I guess I would just add that it's important to draw the links between the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, missing and murdered Native women in this country, poverty on Native reserves and communities, the countless land struggles that Native communities across Canada are engaged in right now with provincial and federal governments, and just really see how they're all connected, and just to, you know, take note of the sort of policies that our government is engaged in and the sort of priorities they say that they have, but then the sort of where they're actually putting their money and where they're actually putting their resources and what their true motivations are for protecting some pieces of land and not others and so on. And, I mean, just looking at the 2010 budget alone, you can see that not only was the Aboriginal Healing Foundation completely cut, but Sisters in Spirit, which is a program of the Native women which is a campaign of the Native Women's Association of Canada, which has done, you know, amazing, groundbreaking research in the last 5 years on the numbers of missing and murdered Native women in this country, and have only begun to really make progress because they've had all sorts of barriers up against the research they were doing, including not even enough funding. Have now had their funding cut entirely in the last budget, and similar to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, an ambiguous $10 million was allotted to dealing with the issue of missing and murdered Native women, but you know, it's not going to Sisters in Spirit, so far as anyone knows yet. The government is supposed to make some sort of announcement at some point when, you know, when, nobody knows, but they're, you know, they've said that they don't want to fund research anymore, so they've taken it away from Sisters in Spirit, and they've said that they want to now fund action instead, but they haven't said how they're going to fund that action, who it's going to go to do that work, and many people are just suspecting that the way they're going to fund the action is to increase police presence on reserves. So you have to really look at what the government's saying and what they're doing, and how different those things are. And then you also have, of course, First Nations University, which, you know, is losing all of their funding at the end of the school year, even though they've, you know, come up with all sorts of plans to better the operation of their school. And anyway, just making the links, I guess, and holding the Canadian government accountable at every possible turn on whatever issue, because they're all linked. So I guess I'd leave it at that.
Okay, well, thanks so much for speaking with me, Maya. And again, anybody who's interested in finding out any more information about Missing Justice or this action can check out Missing Justice's website at missingjustice.ca.